Good morning. My name's Jack Heineman, one of the lay elders here at Fellowship Raleigh. Married, two grown kids, three grandchildren. When I was getting ready to preach this morning, I thought about the last time I was in worship was prior to quarantine and COVID. Last weekend, I wasn't here for the re-entry point because my wife and I were in Madison, Wisconsin, where I got to see my eight-week-old granddaughter for the first time. Jane was up there for the birth, but I finally got up there. So talk about, we have two COVID babies. We had a grandson born down here, and 3 days after, granddaughter born in Wisconsin. So that brings us up to three. So that's different. Another thing that I realized was different is since middle March, this is the second time that I've worn long pants because I've been working from home. So it's been shorts. And even when I went up to Madison, it was shorts. So a second time of wearing long pants. It's just a crazy world with everything going on. Preparing for the sermon, I recall back to the first time I did a sermon, which would have been in about 1985, where I guest pastored at a church who was between pastors. So I'm an accountant, just to be clear. I have a bachelor's in accounting, but I love the Lord. I love the Bible. I love using my limited abilities to share with you guys. But I think back to the first sermon I prepared, and back then, 1984 and 1985, there was no internet. If you had a cell phone, I can't remember if there were cell phones back then. If you had a cell phone, it probably would have been $400 or $500 a month for it. It would have been, you know, tremendously expensive. Preparing for a sermon meant going to the library, checking out some commentaries, sitting at the kitchen table with the Bible and commentaries and working through it. Well, now there's so much information out there. So I'm sitting in the living room. I've got two displays and my laptop, and I've got my phone, and it's looking at commentaries. Oh, click on that link and down that rabbit hole and down this rabbit hole. And then on my phone, there's an ESPN alert. Oh, wow. So it's just a different world, trying to focus. But I had a lot of fun preparing for this morning because we're going to spend a lot of time just reading some verses. And I've always loved history, so the story of David and Saul that we're going to go through today is just incredible to me from a historical point of view. And just from a man, a human point of view, just to know what was going on. So today we're going to talk about integrity. Integrity, when I was thinking about this, the first thing that popped to my mind, and what Matt also had said, was in common kind of definition, description of integrity is, who are you when no one is looking? What do you do when no one is looking? The dictionary defines integrity as firm adherence to a code of especially moral or artistic values, incorruptibility, the quality or state of being complete or undivided. And the synonyms for integrity I thought were real interesting: character, decency, goodness, honesty, morality, righteousness, rightness, uprightness, virtue, virtuousness. I mean, those are all great. Yeah, I want those. That's going to be the antonyms: evil, evil doing, immorality, sin, villainy. And I don't think they're talking about cartoon villains, villainy, and wickedness. So, what's our definition of integrity? We're going to see what David thinks of integrity, and Joseph, and Christ. But what's our definition of integrity? Some anecdotes about what is integrity. I go to the grocery store and I give them a 20 and they give me back change. I give them a 10 and they give me back change for a 20. You know, if I see it as they're doing it, no, you're wrong. You gave me too much. What happens if I've driven 20 minutes to the grocery store, I get home and then I realize they gave me the wrong change? Do I go back? Do I go back then? Do I say, oh, next time I go there, I'll bring them the change back? Which then, if you've ever worked in a cash business like that, If you go back a week later and say, a week ago you gave me $10 too much, it really, they've balanced their cash out, they've balanced their registers, and then they're like, oh, I don't know what we're going to do. You know, but that's one little story. A lack of integrity is a personal story of mine. The way I used to drive to work, I would come to a light where it was a left turn on green only, green arrow only. It was an older intersection, so it had no sensors in it. So if you missed that left arrow, you had to sit through the cycles each way, even at 5 o'clock in the morning when there's nobody around. So being a human, once in a while, and it was like a two-minute cycle, which if you're sitting at a light, you know, it's a long time. So being just a man, once in a while I would look and go. Lack of integrity. We laugh about it. I laugh about it. But it, you know, at the bottom line, used to play pickup basketball at the YMCA, and then I read a story about preparing for this, somebody that played in, they called it their integrity league. Because if you play pickup basketball, you know that almost every time you play pickup basketball, the offense calls a foul. So I'm going to call a foul. If you foul me, I'm calling it on you. At the Y, we played, you call your own fouls. So if I foul you, I'm going to call it on myself. And those of us that played there were used to it. But the interesting thing was when you had somebody show up for the first time, and I would go to block their shot, and they would call a foul on me, and always having the explanation, no, we don't do it that way. We do it where I'll call the foul. But you didn't call it. Well, you didn't give me a chance to call it. So this person called it, when they did it in their league, the integrity league. I like that. It's better than what we were at the Y, which was a bunch of old guys playing basketball at 5:30 in the morning, because teenagers don't get up at 5:30 in the morning to play basketball. Another story about integrity, my wife Jane, who's still in Madison with our daughter, son-in-law, and our eight-week-old granddaughter. Jane and Jennifer went to a volleyball tournament in Rutherfordton, North Carolina, which is a small town. Jane was driving. I had a Sequoia at the time, a Toyota Sequoia. Jane was driving the Sequoia. She came out of the hotel, backed up the Sequoia, and hit a pickup truck that was behind her. Old, beat-up pickup truck. She got out, and she looked at it. The bumper was hanging down. It's night. It's pitch dark. And Jane immediately said, I'm going to go back into the hotel to find the person whose car I hit, which is, wow, that's really cool. On top of that, you know, Jane and Jennifer at that time, Jen was in sixth grade, didn't weigh together as much as I weigh, so they're both tiny. Rutherfordton's pretty rural, and the hotel that was where they were staying was hosting a gun and knife show. So Jane's going to be in rural North Carolina, two little girls. They're going to go into the gun and knife show and say, I hit somebody's pickup truck, which they did. Some man came out, looked at it, said, oh, it was that way before. Don't worry about it, honey, and went away. We see integrity throughout the Bible. We're going to focus on David, but there's a short story about Joseph and Potiphar. So Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery to Potiphar. Joseph is a slave in Potiphar's household. And in Genesis 39, it goes through the story where Potiphar's wife says, ooh, Joseph's a hot, young-looking man. Let's go do wrong stuff. And Joseph says no. Joseph says no. Joseph says no out of respect for Potiphar, his master. Then finally, he runs away, and she grabs his robe, and she is deeply offended by being rejected, yet alone she's rejected by a slave in her household. So, but Joseph says, nope, I have integrity, I have obedience, I'm gonna do what God wills. And it's an example of what did Joseph's integrity cost him? cost him at least 2 years in prison. If I had gotten caught running the red light, okay, I get a ticket. If Jane had actually damaged the person's car, her integrity would have cost us some money for damage. Joseph's integrity cost him at least 2 years in jail. That's integrity. When you do the right thing and it's going to cost you something like that, that's integrity. Small acts, big acts, that's a big act. So now we're going to look at David and what David did. So today we're going to take our next step in learning about David. We've covered the heart of courage, David's battle with Goliath. We've covered the heart of friendship with Jonathan. Today we're going to look at David's heart of integrity. Joseph's integrity cost him 2 years in prison. David's integrity, on at least two specific occasions we're going to cover today, could have easily led to his death. So we're going to read through 1 Samuel 24, the whole chapter. It's a long passage, but there's a lot to it, and then we'll dig into it. So 1 Samuel 24, starting at verse 1. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand? For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, 'Out of the wickedness comes wickedness,' but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." As soon as David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." And David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. Lord, thank you for your word. We thank you for the example we can see in David and Joseph and Christ especially, to have integrity, to follow you in all things. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen. So a little background. Saul has been pursuing David. Most of the commentaries that said Saul's, is that, did you guys hear that? Is that better? Can you get, okay, sorry about that. So Saul's been pursuing David. Commentators say that Saul pursued David for some 4 to 7 years. When did this occur? I don't know. I'm gonna say it occurred for a year into this pursuit. Might have been longer, might have been a little shorter. But Saul has been chasing David for a while. David has 600 men with him. Saul has 3,000. One of the commentators I read said, crack battle troops. So Saul has 3,000 crack battle troops. So it's not the retired security guard at our facilities. You know, it's not David's got airborne rangers with him. He's got SEAL team guys with him. He's got Delta Force guys with him. Saul does. I'm sorry. Saul has 3,000 airborne rangers with him. Saul has 3,000 SEAL team guys with him. So he's got crack battle troops. These guys are hardened in battle. They are the best of the best, as you'd expect to be with the king. I mean, they're his personal bodyguard, his personal army. You would expect them to be the best. And David's got 600 guys with them. How badly does Saul want to kill David? Well, two chapters earlier, we read that David was sheltered by spent some time with some priests. And it doesn't appear that the priest knew that David was running from Saul or that Saul was chasing David. But when Saul found out that David had spent time with these priests and they didn't let Saul know about it, Saul had 85 of these priests and their family put to death. So that's contextually, this is Saul chasing and wanting to kill David is not an afterthought in Saul's mind. He is going scorched earth policy. Anybody that has touch with David, anybody that helps David, he's taken them out, including 85 priests. At the end of the previous chapter, it appears that Saul is close to getting David. Until a messenger comes and tells Saul that the Philistines, Israel's enemies, are raiding the land. So think about what that means. It means that the Philistines are on the border of Israel. They've been at war with the Philistines. But Saul is more worried about chasing David and killing David than he is in actually protecting the borders of his own land, of protecting his people. So he is clearly myopically focused on that, on getting David. So his hatred and fear of David was so great that he was more worried about this one man than he was about the Philistine army. So Saul leaves, he deals with the Philistines, and he comes back. And immediately returns to the chase of David. And I read that and I'm thinking, I wonder if David rolls his eyes and says, oh, really? You're back? You got to be kidding. Don't you have more important things to deal with than this? And at the end of the thing, when David says, are you chasing a dead dog? Are you chasing a flea? That's him kind of saying to Saul, I'm one man. What are you doing? Why are you trying to chase me? Why are you trying to kill me? So David hides in a cave. And then we see God's providence, God's sovereignty, God's sense of humor maybe, where Saul has to relieve himself. And Saul goes in to relieve himself in the very cave that David and his men are hiding in. I read that Jewish custom and law is pretty strict about relieving yourself. You can't just go to a tree. I mean, you've got to go off by yourself. You've got to dig a hole. You've got to, you know, there's ritualistic things to relieving yourself. So Saul goes off by himself, and what do David's men think? And what Jack, as a person, I think, I'm the anointed king. This guy's trying to kill me for no reason. I've done nothing to indicate that I am a threat to him. I'm perfectly justified in killing Saul, in my human way of thinking. It's self-defense. I mean, it's proactive self-defense. It's the castle doctrine. I'm protecting myself from an intimate threat, so I'm gonna go after him. So just shows David's restraint is just amazing. It shows David's respect for the Lord to see God's will and God's desire instead of the person in front of him who has been dedicating all the resources of his kingdom to killing David. It takes overwhelming faith in the Lord to trust him to remove an obstacle like that rather than taking matters into our own hands. David's men, they think like I would probably think. In verse 4, they say, "Here's the day, David. Here's the day where the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Can't find anywhere in the Bible that it actually says that God said that to David, but these are soldiers, and they're just, I think they're kind of interpreting a little bit. We're hiding here. Saul comes in. He's our enemy. Clearly, this is God giving you a sign that this is your chance, David. This is your chance. And oh, by the way, it's our chance to stop running also. You know, we're 600 men. It's our chance to stop running from the SEAL teams that are chasing us. So what does David do? I'm just imagining they're back in the cave. Saul's towards the front of the cave. Men are saying, "Go, go, go." And David says, "Okay, I'll be right back." So David leaves. And what does David do? Sneaks up on Saul. Cuts off a corner of Saul's robe. Saul relieves himself. He puts the robe, you know, over on a rock a little bit away. So David goes up and cuts not with scissors. You know, David's a soldier, so he's either got a sword or a knife. He doesn't have cuticle scissors. You know, he doesn't have a manicure set with him. He's got a weapon that he is using. So Saul's here. Here's the robe, and David is cutting this off when his men are saying, "All you have to do is reach out. Just reach out and do it. It's easy." And kind of a side note, but not, is that David even feels bad about doing that. You know, he feels that shows disrespect to the Lord's anointed. So, you know, at the beginning I said, Saul shows back up again. And I wonder if David says, "Really?" So now I'm thinking, what do David's men think when he goes off to, they probably think to kill Saul, and David comes back and says, "Hey, look what I did. I got a corner of his robe." They're probably like, "Really? That's it? You cut off a corner of his robe?" But David knows that this isn't about him. And it's not about Saul either. It's about obedience to God. It's about integrity and obedience to God. David says, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord," small l, "my king, the Lord's anointed, to put on my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." You know, the term "the Lord's anointed" in these couple of stories here are used 3, 4, 5 times by David. Saul is the Lord's anointed. That's all that matters to David, is he's anointed by the Lord. Found a commentator with Gerard Van Groningen. Says, "Why did David consider the anointed to be inviolate, to be kept from attack, and to be preserved from degradation? The answer lies in the fact that once anointed, the individual, Saul, was set apart or consecrated to God. A specific bond was established in relation to God, in separation from men and women in general, and from the common aspects of life in particular. Hence, to touch, defile, or attack the anointed ones was to approach the Lord himself and to seek to defile, harm, and remove the Lord from his rightful place." So that's what David views this as. It's not cutting off Saul's robe, corner of Saul's robe, is not cutting off Saul's robe. It's cutting off the Lord's authority, yet alone killing. Killing Saul wasn't about killing Saul or not doing it. It was about he's the Lord's anointed. It's out of respect for God, not out of Saul, the man himself. David was offered a shortcut to the kingship. He's the anointed one. You know, David is going to be the king. He knows that. He's been anointed by Samuel. He's going to be the king. He had a shortcut, just as we see in the temptation of Christ, another type of shortcut. Satan tells Christ, "All you have to do is kneel down and everything is yours," like that. Immediately. Nobody's going to see. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, of course. You know, Satan's, "Nobody's going to see. We're out in the middle of the desert. Nobody's going to know that you knelt down to me. And all of a sudden, guess what? You don't have to go through everything. You don't have to be persecuted for 3 years. You don't have to stand in front of these judges and be that. You're not going to get whipped. You're not going to be crown of thorns. You're not going to be crucified. All you have to do is do that. Shortcut to Jesus. But of course, here Christ shows the same integrity that David showed. God's will in eternity comes through the cross and obedience. There are no shortcuts. You know, when I read that, I thought, well, there actually is a shortcut. We have the shortcut, in a manner of thinking. Christ, our belief in, you know, think about what Christ had to do and what David had to do, and what do we need to do to have eternal salvation? It is a type of a shortcut. You know, yeah, when we see the big picture, being a Christian and having eternity is, we're not going to be crucified. Christ took the long road so that we could take the shortcut. We have to submit ourselves. We have to put ourselves down a little bit, know that we can't do it on our own, but we don't have to be crucified. We're not whipped, especially in this area, in this country. You know, none of us, we're not worried about being hauled out of our house for being a Christian and being persecuted. So the shortcut we have, in a manner of speaking, is because of what Christ and David as before Christ did. So, you know, now, so David's got the corner of the robe. One of the commentaries I said, you know, he rebukes his men saying, no, I can't kill Saul. The Hebrew actually reads, he tore apart his men. So it wasn't like, hey guys, no, he's the Lord's anointed. It was very vehemently, he's the Lord's anointed. I cannot kill him. That violates God's will, period. As much as, maybe, I don't know, did David want to, as much as it might make it easy for us, that's not God's will, and that's what we're going to do. In the next phase of the story, Saul leaves the cave, and then David afterward comes out of the cave, probably making sure that Saul was far enough away. I mean, David's, you know, out of range. And then David calls out, my Lord the King. And he doesn't call it out sarcastically or ironically. He calls it out because Saul is his king. Saul turns and sees David bowing his face, not only calling out, but David's on his hands and knees with his head to the ground, paying homage to Saul. The man who's trying to kill him, David is still honoring Saul, but really honoring God. So I had to think, what does Saul think? He relieves himself, he comes out, he's walking back to camp, and all of a sudden he hears this guy who's been chasing him. Hey, Saul, I'm up here. Goosebumps, confusion, what in the world just occurred? Something like that. And then Saul turns around, and what's the first thing David says? Why do you believe those who say I seek to harm you? David knows that Saul's jealousy and fear of David is being fed by sycophants, yes men, in the royal court and in the military, as happens today in every position of power. Every position of power has the yes men around them, yes women around them. Every power structure in history, because those are the people that see their power tied to Saul. So they're going to do everything they can to make sure that Saul is happy and Saul stays in power, because if I'm a general in Saul's army, I'm in a pretty high place, and I have that because of Saul, so I'm going to make sure he stays there. So then David shows Saul the corner of the robe that he cut off, and now again I'm thinking, so Saul turns around and sees David, confusion, goosebumps. Now David shows him a corner of the robe, and now Saul realizes, now he breaks it out into a cold sweat, because now he realizes that David was easily within striking distance of killing him. So Saul is probably just getting that. Saul probably needs to go find another cave to relieve himself after seeing David with the corner of the robe. I know that's what I would feel. But why is David showing him the corner of the road? Because he's saying, Saul, I'm not your enemy. Look at you know by me having the corner of the road, you know what I could have done, but I am not your enemy. And then David points out that others were telling me I should kill you, meaning his men were telling him I should kill you. And again, David's not doing this out of love for Saul, fact that Saul at one point was his father-in-law, or even the confusion. You know, I read a lot of history, and you read about empires and leaders being usurped. And I read this, and I thought, you know, if David kills Saul, probably not all 3,000 of those troopers are going to follow David right away. There's going to be confusion in the kingdom. There's going to be other, you know, maybe a little bit of a start of a civil war. David's not thinking about that. It's strictly because Saul is the Lord's anointed. David says, I could have done it, but I'm not going to because you are the Lord's anointed. The respect David has for the anointed king is incredible and so Christ-like. It reminded me a little bit of how when Christ is brought up before the high priest and Pilate, he doesn't laugh at him. He doesn't, you know, he makes a little comment about all power is you have is from my Father, but he doesn't say, Pilate, you know, you're nothing. I'm the Son of God. Just don't even bother me. You know, so Christ shows that same type of obedience and integrity in what he did, and he could have spared himself suffering, as I said, just like David could have. Then David moves on. So David is making the case that he doesn't intend to harm Saul. He is not a threat to him. But then David goes and says, but I'm not, David says, I'm not going to judge between you and I. Let the Lord judge between you and I. May the Lord judge between you and me. And by doing this, David frees himself from the phrase I read that I liked was, he frees himself from the soul-eating experience of revenge. You know, if he had killed Saul, yeah, he might have felt good for a little while, but that revenge, that feeling of revenge, and we all have had it at one level or another, that wanting to get revenge, and oh, if I could just do that, I would get that guy back. I'd get that woman back for doing that to me. And I like the term soul-eating. But David just says, it's not in my hands. It's in God's hands. Whatever happens between you and me is going to be up to God. Again, obedience to God. That's what David's all about. Integrity and obedience to God. Now we get to Saul, and what does Saul say? Saul seems to realize how wrong he is. You are more righteous than I. You will be the king. All I ask is that you don't kill me or my household or anything else. And David says, okay, I won't. When I become king, I won't. Of course, the interesting part is at the end of chapter 24, it says Saul goes his way and David goes his way. So David says, I could have killed you. Saul says, oh, David, you're so wonderful. I was wrong to chase after you. You know, you could, but there's no happy running together and hugging or shaking hands and saying, okay, let's go break bread together. They go the separate ways. A commentator called Dale Ralph Davis said about this thing, when David goes his own way, to be reassured is one thing, to be stupid is another. And David's not stupid. So David hears everything Saul has to say, and he's still like, yeah, I'm not so sure I'm ready to actually believe you. We'll skip to chapter 26. Won't read the passage. It's a very similar story. Chapter 24, David catches Saul in the cave. In chapter 26, Saul's army is camped, and David goes into the camp with one of his men, Abishai, at night, and steals Saul's spear. So Saul is sleeping. David gets his spear and leaves in the middle of the night. So once again, close enough to kill Saul, but he doesn't. He just takes the spear. And again, we see a similar play out of the next few verses. One of the interesting things is that in chapter 24, David calls out to Saul. In chapter 26, the first person he calls out is to Abner. Abner, cousin of Saul, general in Saul's army, probably. In 2 Samuel, it says, during the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. So Abner's one of those yes men, He's one of those sycophants that says, Saul, you're the greatest. David's evil. Saul, you're the greatest. You know, just feeding Saul, telling Saul what he wants to hear so he can gain and keep power. And this is where David shows kind of like a human side that I would show. He said, he basically holds a spear up and says, hey, Abner, bodyguard to the king. Nah. Look what I have. I have a spear. What kind of job are you doing? Come on, dude. You're supposed to be guarding the king, but I snuck in and I stole his spear. So a little bit of a jab at Abner there, but not at Saul, but at Abner. So then Saul hears David. He comes out and he pretty much says the same thing he said in chapter 24. Oh, David, you're so good. I'm so bad. Thank you for not killing me. I was wrong. You know, that type of stuff. But again, David knows better and doesn't join Saul. They go their own way. So in these two chapters, two stories, we see very real and tangible examples of the integrity of David. He is fully committed to obeying and honoring God, no matter the consequences. Like I said, when I run a red light, I might get a ticket. You know, dinging somebody's car door in the parking lot, you might have to pay for some damages. Joseph's integrity cost him at least 2 years in prison. When David did these, he doesn't know what's going on. I mean, there's a real possibility that David's integrity could have cost him his life, because Saul clearly isn't going to stop. So David has passed his chance up, and David, even though he knows he's the anointed, he's got to be thinking, when he does this, I hope that doesn't turn out wrong. I hope that Saul doesn't come after me. So we see that David does this act with integrity regardless of the consequences. Big consequences doesn't mean that our acts of integrity don't matter. And that's not, I don't mean to say, as long as you don't kill somebody that's harming you, that's great. Small acts of integrity matter also, because it shows both believers and maybe even more importantly, non-believers, that we answer to God's laws and expectations, not to man's. As Christ did by accepting the cross and being obedient to God, showing that he served a higher power and was more concerned about eternity than how the world viewed him, we do the same thing every time we act with integrity. Every time we act with integrity, even the smallest act shows who we belong to, who we follow, who we believe in. And unfortunately, or something to remember, is every time we act without integrity, we weaken our witness. Sorry. We are in the world, but not of the world. If visitors or somebody watching online who's a non-believer, I'm not, but let's say I was the greatest preacher ever and just touched everybody's heart and they said, oh, that's great. And then let's say some non-believer sees me tomorrow in a parking lot and someone has kind of blocked me in a little bit and I'm standing out there yelling at them and swearing at them. Well, guess what? Doesn't matter how good a preacher I am. Doesn't matter how perfect my knowledge of this book is. They're going to be looking at that. So when we act with integrity or not, we serve witness to our witness. We serve witness to who do we serve? To who do we belong? And then I found this. In a daily devotional, just kind of looking through and show me stuff about integrity. And daily devotional, this is great for us to think about as we go forward. In what ways have I been a person of integrity when it was tough? When did I have risk? When was it tough to be a person of integrity? When have I failed? I'm sure we've all can point, look at things in our lives that we've done and it's like, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Sometimes it's little things. Sometimes it's big things. You know, if you cheated somebody out of something, whether a business or anything like that, you know, sometimes that. Whose standards do and what do I need to change? And then kind of in closing, no legacy is as rich as integrity. I wish I'd come up with that. I didn't. But that is just so good. And so I have a third, as I said, Jane and I have a 30-year-old son and a 28-year-old son. Both phenomenal people. Walking with the Lord and, you know, which we love, but one of the kind of a funny story is, I grew up not real rough, but foul language is pretty much part of my nature when I was growing up, up until I was probably 17 or 18 years old. And a few years ago, I can't remember what we were talking about that. And my kids said to me, wow, I don't think we've ever heard you curse, which kind of, it's a little thing, but you know, when I was doing this, I thought that's one, hopefully I've left them other positive thoughts, but even that was just like, okay, I'm doing something right. God's watching us. We should all, you know, we know that. I mean, we read that throughout the Bible. You know, no matter if I'm in the deepest of the sea or highest of the mountains, you're watching me. Your eye is on me. But people are watching us also. And as believers, we, you know, should be acting with integrity should be automatic. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes the easy way is to take the shortcut. And we just need to remember that whatever we do, good or bad, we're witness to the world. And that might be kind of heavy, but nowadays, everything that's going on, the world needs Christianity. The world needs Christ. The world needs us to be Christ-like in everything we do. We need to, you know, that's the only way we're going to get through everything is through Christ. He brings us together. He brings us together, believers and non-believers. Our love should shine through, and we should always act like we are modeling Christ. Like David said, it's not about Saul. It's not about David. It's about God. It's about Christ. And the more we read, the more time we spend in the Word, it becomes automatic. So as we go throughout the week and the time ahead, let's remember, it's all about Christ.